Well, good morning. And welcome. I'm Frank Verastro. I'm director of the energy program here at CSIS. There's a lot of familiar faces out there. This is the eighth session that we've done on alternative transportation fuels. And I got to tell you, when we started this last year, none of us envisioned that it would be this big. We knew it was going to be a timely issue and it was an important issue. But throughout the session, I think we've all learned a lot about technology, infrastructure, the enormous investment in lead times, what it takes, the promise of alternative fuels, but the real need to stay with fossil fuels to get us through this transition period. The sessions that we started, we've gone through technology, automotive technology. You've seen a lot on biofuels and alternatives. Today we're going to talk about infrastructure, which is really one of the keys, because when you talk about replacing or displacing fossil fuel use in this country, it's an enormous challenge. It takes a lot of money, a lot of time. It's like steering an oil tanker. You do it a little bit over a long period. Our panel this morning is just terrific. I should tell you, because a couple of people have already commented about it, we understand that there was a hole in the panel discussion. We actually had contacted two of the big ethanol producers and suppliers, and for various reasons, scheduling, one late-minute cancellation, they're not with us today. We'll try to get that piece of it and post all these presentations on the website. With the permission of our panelists, we'll post it probably by the end of the week, because all this material is publicly available information. The series that we started, we did in conjunction with the Global Strategy Institute here at CSIS and also with the National Renewable Energy Lab. And Dr. Doug Arendt from NREL is with us this morning. He's been at previous sessions. He's also a senior research associate here at CSIS. At the conclusion of this series, we intend to produce a document, that's not surprising, that'll compile the data and the presentations that we've seen, have some key insights and a little bit of analysis. We're looking to close this session off, the series off with this session, and later this fall we're going to do an international biofuels component, because as we look at global demand for all fuels, and just as an advisory, we have Guy Caruso coming here on Monday afternoon to introduce the 2007 version of the EIA, IEO, the International Energy Outlook. So you're all invited to come to that as well. I think, as I said before, this is the session is on the record, but if you'll hold your questions till the end, that'll be terrific. And Eric Peterson will be joining us to do a comment session as we wrap up. So with those opening comments, I'll turn this over to Doug and enjoy the program. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Good morning, everyone. So we'll move forward relatively rapidly. This morning what we're going to do is hear from each of the panelists. We're going to take a quick break after the second panelist to facilitate some networking, and hopefully you can all visit some old friends or meet some new ones. And then we'll do a relatively extended Q&A session toward the end, and then welcome some closing remarks from Eric. So you have bios. If you do not have bios, they're printed and they're out in the hallway. I encourage you to get them and read through them in detail, as I will not read them in detail for you, just to keep time going forward for us. But we're going to start with Shirley Neff in her role as the president and CEO of the Association of Oil Pipelines. And so we're going to welcome Shirley and thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
And on the computer,
my presentation.
If we just do that, it's there.
Thank you. Okay, there we go. Okay. I'm going to give you just a quick run through of the pipeline industry's perspective on biofuels. This is just a map to show you where the infrastructure is in the United States. As you can see, crude oil and petroleum products are supplied to major demand centers all around the United States. The pipelines originate where the current production exists, a lot in the Gulf Coast, and as you can see in the Mid-Continent and in other producing regions. And some of these lines are crude lines that deliver crude oil into refineries that are dispersed around the country. The rest, the blue ones, are the refined product pipelines. and I'll show you a more detailed map of that in a second. Pipelines are, without question, the most efficient and least expensive mechanism for mode for transporting liquid fuels. They're also the safest. Here's a map that shows you the refined product pipelines, and the yellow circles or ovals on there are refining centers. So as you can see, the configuration of the current pipeline, refined product pipeline system, is geared toward moving product from Gulf Coast refineries, these big lines up into the Northeast, that's Colonial and Plains. They move product all the way up into the Washington area and north. Imports of crude oil come into those East Coast refineries. There are refineries in the Midwest that are supplied with crude from the Gulf Coast and Canada, and then there's a distribution network in that region. Likewise, most of these pipelines take product from refineries in, say, the Rocky Mountain region and the West Coast. But you can see we don't exactly have a system that to move product from the Midwest, where most of the ethanol production and biofuels production currently exists. We don't have the pipelines aren't configured to operate that way. It's just a function of the history of the industry and how it developed. Right now, the pipeline industry has a number of challenges. Supply and distribution patterns are changing. Everybody knows about the huge increase in production coming out of the Rocky Mountains and the oil sands in Canada. There are some major expansion projects to bring crude oil. So they're crude oil pipelines from Canada down into the Midwest, likewise out of the Rocky Mountains. The refined product sector is seeing additional growth in demand in some southern markets, you know, the Las Vegas area and some other southern regions where, you know, we've had substantial population growth. So there's expansion of capacity into those markets. And liquid pipelines do not have federal eminent domain authority, so anytime there's a new greenfield project that isn't just a, you know, an expansion or looping of an existing system, it means negotiating and acquiring rights of way. And that's a real challenge, as everyone in the sector knows. There's also increased competition, pipeline-on-pipeline competition, as well as other modes of transportation. There's a lot of, over 20% of the refined product moves on barges right now, and there's some with tanker trucks, so it sort of depends. You know, it's a question of when you build additional pipeline capacity. That's one of the issues in Las Vegas right now. I mean, we keep hearing from politicians in the Vegas area asking why the industry hasn't expanded. Well, there's already truck transportation going in there, so it's a question of when do you have enough capacity that you can justify building a pipeline. Again, demand growth has resulted in tight capacity in various regions. So just to supply the current, you know, slate of products, the industry is having to expand capacity. And keep in mind, petroleum refined product pipelines are multi-product pipelines. They move diesel, gasoline, jet fuel, you know, a range of fuels and different grades within those different categories. And the number of boutique fuels has actually been expanding more rapidly recently, although there's all this talk about reducing the number of boutique fuels. With ultra-low sulfur diesel, that's required industry to expand terminal capacity. The introduction of biofuels throughout the country has meant conversion of tanks from, you know, other products from gasoline, jet fuel, you know, standard distillate products into ethanol and biodiesel tanks. So that means there's less overall capacity for any individual fuel, especially in the coastal high population areas. Industry's been expanding terminal and tank capacity, you know, throughout the mid part of the country, but it's more complicated in coastal areas where land is at a premium. So you see that there's less flexibility at the terminals in some of those areas. And in fact, I'll just as an aside mention that there's a city in the Northeast, New Haven, Connecticut, that is actually studying the possibility of condemning an existing refined product terminal so they can convert that section of the port into a passenger ferry terminal. Just so happens that part of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve's refined product reserve is behind that terminal, but that hasn't dissuaded them. And that would really tighten capacity there in that area where a lot of fuel comes into the Northeast. So just I tell you that to give you a sense of how complicated it is for the industry to expand capacity. And obviously there are substantial investment requirements. The industry is regulated by the Office of Pipeline Safety, part of the Department of Transportation, and there's a very sophisticated integrity management program that applies to the distribution system and to the pipelines and their extensive safety requirements. So the industry, you know, it's not just as simple as some people would believe. There are some clearly identified challenges to pipeline transportation of ethanol, and you've all heard this. Ethanol has an affinity for water. Fuel ethanol in the United States can contain no more than 1% water. Now, the pipeline system, the multi-product pipeline system in the U.S. does have some water in it. Water enters the system from products coming out of refineries, also at tanks and terminals along the pipeline. It's not a huge amount of water. I mean, it's not a problem for any other products that are transported through the system. The industry uses cleaning pigs that go through the line and scrape out the water, and, you know, there's ongoing maintenance that to prevent problems with corrosion, et cetera, that could occur if you had a lot of water sitting in a pipeline. But nonetheless, there is some water in most of the system. And transporting ethanol in a system with any water can lead to, in blends, it can lead to phase separation. In other words, the ethanol blends with the water and then separates from the gasoline. At that point, when a batch of blended gasoline gets to, you know, a terminal point where it's offloaded, when the gasoline is separated from the ethanol, it has to be removed. And right now there's no technology or there's no way to re-blend it. So the experience the industry's had from some tests in the past is that the ethanol is contaminated and then has to be disposed of as hazardous waste. There hasn't been a lot of transportation of ethanol. There were experiments by a variety of companies back in the 80s and then in the early 90s when the oxygenate mandate was put into place, and some of these issues were discovered, and then we all know how the market sort of sorted out. But there's been some experience with this, and this has been the result. There's also an effect of scouring. When just neat ethanol, and we don't actually transport neat ethanol. It's denatured. It's got a little bit of gasoline in it so that it's not food-quality ethanol. But what happens is, I mean, it's alcohol. So it, you know, it cleans off the pipeline. It's not that pipelines are dirty per se, but, you know, there are drag-reducing agents and other residues from other products that, you know, coat the pipeline walls. The ethanol goes through it, and it pulls some of that off, and it contaminates the ethanol. There were some experiments by the Williams Company back in the early 90s. This is on the public record. They submitted some information on it to one of the House committees, I think. And they batched neat ethanol from Kansas City to their terminal in Des Moines and found that, you know, they could maintain product quality over time, but that there was some deterioration. Well, you have to be careful how you transport neat ethanol in a pipeline to avoid deterioration, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later on. The big challenge, though, for the industry is what's called stress corrosion cracking. There have been some cases, and in fact, I pulled this directly from an announcement that just came out from API. They've got an updated technical report. It's 939D. This will be on the web, so if you want to get a copy of this, you'll be able to get it from API here pretty soon. We had a draft of it yesterday at a meeting I was at, but so far there's just the announcement. And what API has done is that there's a survey, certainly, of all the literature and the research that's been done on this particular phenomenon. But they surveyed the industry to find out, you know, what experience people had had since the last version of this, which I think was in 2003. And there have been about 24 cases of cracking and leaks that have occurred at various storage and terminal equipment where ethanol has been contained and blended. It's primarily, I mean, there's a fair amount of ethanol blended, you know, throughout the country, as everyone knows, with reformulated gasoline, and certainly in the Midwest, in, you know, just gasohol, 10% blends, et cetera. We haven't. They didn't uncover any cracking, stress corrosion cracking at any manufacturing facilities. There has been one pipeline that's had a failure. It was a pipeline, an existing product pipeline that was converted to an ethanol line. It was a very short line in the West Coast, on the West Coast in that area. So far, there hasn't been any problem with E85 blends, but, you know, I mean, everybody's a little bit cautious. Now, stress corrosion cracking is not the same sort of corrosion that you typically think of, where you get some sort of an abrasion and then you have, you know, corrosion that occurs around it. It's a very fine pitting with hairline cracks that occur amongst the pit. Somebody described it as pipeline eczema. And it's very hard to detect. And there's a lot of research going on right now that the industry has initiated. Now, again, this is all developing very rapidly, this expansion of biofuels. And when the industry looked at, you know, the question of transporting biofuels back in the early 90s, again, when the oxygenate standard came out, and, you know, even from based on tests from earlier when we started the gasohol markets, industry looked at it, as it was kind of determined that MTBE was going to be used in a lot of the coastal regions, the ethanol was being blended in markets where it was not too distant from production facilities. So after some tests, industry concluded that the SCC issue and some of the product quality issues were enough to just go with the existing rail car and tanker transportation, so there wasn't a big R&D campaign initiated. So we have been doing that now. There's the first stage of research, detailed research on stress corrosion cracking specific to ethanol, was started this last year. Now, SCC is an issue that occurs, you know, on the exterior of pipelines. There are other, you know, causes for that, but the internal SCC is specific to ethanol. The Pipeline Research Council International is just has just come to its first, you know, conclusions on this initial study. The intent was to try to understand the potential threat, whether it was really a serious issue or just a minor problem, and to develop guidelines to prevent SCC. In fact, this afternoon or today in Calgary, the technical committee of the PRCI is meeting to scope out the next phase of the R&D, and they're going to look at some more detailed studies into environmental factors and stressing conditions that could promote SCC. Now, the ethanol industry has said repeatedly in testimony and in public statements that there's not a problem transporting ethanol because they've been doing it in Brazil for years. Well, it so happens that Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, is one of the co-funders of this research. And while we've not been very successful in getting detailed information about problems that the industry may have had in Brazil, the fact that they are working with us here suggests that they are concerned about the same issues. I'll leave it at that. We can talk about that later. The future prospects within the industry, I think our chairman, Mike Mears from Magellan, has said that he believes that transportation of 10% ethanol blends in existing pipelines may prove to be technically feasible. It's really a question of whether we can get at this concern with stress corrosion cracking. And you've heard probably press reports about companies saying, oh, they're going to convert lines to ethanol or they're going to be shipping ethanol. I've talked to the presidents of all these pipeline companies. Yes, they're interested. They're looking at this. This is a market opportunity for the pipeline industry. These folks do not sell product. They transport it. And the more product you can transport, the more you can fill your pipelines, you know, the better. But until they can be certain that they're not going to undermine the integrity of an asset, you know, everybody is very cautious. Mike, Magellan, by the way, is the successor to the Williams pipeline. They have a very large system in the northern Midwest. They're the ones that did the test back in the early 90s. Now, that's a question of they think they can, you know, make the system watertight enough that they won't have the problem with phase separation. Fuel ethanol is a little more challenging because of the issue that I described where you have to maintain the product quality while you're batching a variety of fuels. But this is all dependent on, again, the SCC issue. Prospects for a dedicated ethanol pipeline. You know, this is something that everybody seems to have caught on to. There have been, you know, various studies done by you know, certain consultants, the ethanol industry is talking about it, legislation's been introduced to study dedicated ethanol pipelines. The reality is, though, I mean, pipelines are long-lived assets. They go across, you know, private, public property, et cetera. You have to be able to site, permit a pipeline. We're talking about a lot of steel in the ground. And the typical cost of pipeline construction is about $1 million a mile. Now, one of the reasons that product is transported now by barge and rail car and tanker truck in a number of areas is that there's not justification, there's not significant volume to merit building a pipeline. So in order to consider building this pipeline, this mythic pipeline from the Midwest to the East Coast that we keep hearing about, there are a number of factors that would have to be considered and addressed before somebody would put up the money. First and foremost is long-term commitments from ethanol producers. Right now we're seeing a lot of mandates around the Midwest that increasing volumes of ethanol be blended within various states. In fact, Minnesota is trying to go beyond 10% to 15 or 20%. Now, if we wind up with a lot of mandates that keep the current ethanol production in the producing region, then there may not be ethanol available to move to the East Coast. Now, everybody talks about the development of dispersed cellulosic fuels. We haven't seen that yet. And, in fact, there's no commercial production, so, you know, keep in mind, that could be another competing element. If you do have cellulosic fuels in the East Coast, you know, the state of New York is looking forward to having this burgeoning cellulosic market. Then the question is, do you actually have demand on the other end? Ethanol plants are relatively small. When you consider the volumes that are required for a pipeline, we'd have to have some sort of aggregation systems within a region to get enough volume to justify building a plant to baseload a pipeline. I mean, keep in mind, you've got to have a certain amount of product just in the pipeline to keep the fluid moving, so you'd have to fill it, first of all. And then there's a whole question of distribution systems at the other end. And right now, the regulatory jurisdiction for these facilities is not entirely clear. We think FERC would assert jurisdiction, but, you know, that's not clear. The Office of Pipeline Safety at DOT has said they have jurisdiction, but, you know, they haven't put that in writing. So there are some questions there as well. But the major issue here is really economic. You know, people don't just build pipelines because it's a good idea. So with that, I'll conclude my comments. And we can talk about biodiesel issues a little later. I just sort of left it just to the ethanol discussion because that's the main focus right now.
Super. Thank you, Shirley. Let's see. We have to do some logistics pieces. Our next speaker is Charles Banks. He's the president of, let me see if I can do this, R.L. Banks & Associates. And if you've read his bio, it's actually quite interesting. He's coming to us with a very different perspective, having worked for a number of different railroads. And I think you'll find his perspective in some of the numbers that he's going to put up fairly intriguing as we think about this. And so please join me in welcoming Charles Banks.
Thanks, Thank Charles. You. At least we hope you'll find them intriguing.
Oh, I know they will be.
I am going to try to address four different modes, but since Shirley's covered the pipeline business so well and since she knows it so much better than I do, I will skip over that. But you will see some things when it gets up on the web that where I've addressed the pipeline, but I'll skip it here largely. I worked for the in one of the railroads I work for, person who went on to be president of Delta Airlines, Leo Mullen, and he was the youngest partner ever at McKinsey Company, and he said that that bright, business-oriented, and policy people can only take away three messages maximum. So make it simple for him by telling him up front. I figure if he got to be partner, he at 22 or something like that, that he probably knows what he's doing. So here are the messages, and then you can tune me out for the rest of my presentation. The capacity of all freight transportation options is becoming severely constrained and will only get worse. That's number one. Number two, dramatic increases in domestically produced biofuels will increase demands on already constrained transportation infrastructure, and therefore new solutions and approaches need to be evaluated. Now, I'm a transportation expert, and they're basically most policy people look at transportation in two dimensions. One is to look at it in terms of revenue, and one of them is to look at it in terms of volume or tonnage or gallons handled. So I'm going to show it to you both ways. This is the latest data that I can get, which would appear to be consistent. The source, however, is the Association of American Railroads, so I won't speak to its accuracy. This data is 2001, although it was produced in 2006. So if you look at it this way, trucks handle 80.4%, earned 80.4% of freight revenues. These are all commodities now in the United States, with railroads handling a little less than 10%. Domestic air is relatively high at 5%. It's tiny volume-wise, but like trucks, the airlines tend to handle high-value merchandise, and people pay a premium for it. Oil pipelines garnered about 2.5% of freight revenues. Freight forwarders, who are basically brokers, handled 2%, and domestic waterways, barges, et cetera, a little less than 1%. And you get a different picture, substantially different picture, if you look at it on the basis of volume. You get this picture. Rail has the majority. Sorry, not the majority, but the largest single market share. This is a measuring using ton miles, which means hauling a ton 1 mile. Rail has 40%. Trucks drop to 30. Pipeline jumps up, as Shirley pointed out, somewhere in the vicinity of the high teens to 20, and barges and inland waterway users are in excess of 10%. Now, the total biofuels consumption here, I'm adding ethanol and biodiesel anyway, as you can see, has largely been rising and at a very high rate thanks to the ethanol consumption. But I want you to keep in mind that, at least with respect to rail, while the number of gallons is a large number, it translated into something like 80,000 carloads in 2005. Now, it's increasing at a very rapid rate, but it went from, I think, 70,000 in 2004 to 84,000 in 2005. But the U.S. railroad industry handled 30 million cars that year, car loads that year. So it's just a tiny percentage of the U.S. railroad volume today. People love this slide for some reason, so I keep showing it. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but when you think about infrastructure being tight, there are a lot of different ways in which it can have an impact. Everything being equal, pipelines, particularly if they're pipelines, are don't really impact those of us who have to drive and walk and et cetera, because once they're built, at least they're underground and they're not particularly troublesome. They're particularly safe, as Shirley pointed out. Barges handle tremendous volumes, so one barge, looking at the top row, second item. One barge tow can handle 6.8 million gallons, 15 barges being pulled. A 100-car tank train can only handle a 100-car train of, in this case, hopper cars, can only handle about half that volume. And a truck, a trailer, can only handle about 26 tons, so it doesn't compare. And if you look down under this equivalent units, you can see that the 15-barge tow carries the equivalent of 870 trucks. So obviously, the less we can move in trucks and the more we can move in tows, we'd be better off. And I've got some length dimensions there for those of you who are interested. This is really based on not on tanks. There's a slightly different relationship if we're talking about moving ethanol product, but this is more actually to do with moving grain in to ethanol plants. The purpose of this slide, which I'm not going to dwell on, is that every mode has things that it does extremely well and things that it doesn't do quite as well. And really, if America is going to remain competitive going forward, we're going to have to take advantage of what each mode does well. And I would also say there'll have to be a sharing. You know, if the demand is there to move product by pipeline, as an American, I want it moving as much by pipeline as possible. But there are places where the volumes may not be there for the pipeline to make sense. And even though I'm a railroader and a rail advocate, there are places where the volume might even be too small even for the railroads to make sense. So we're all going to have to distribute the transportation of this fuel in a logical way across these modes if we're going to keep our competitive edge. Now, the motor carriers face huge challenges, in my view, not the least of which is fuel prices. Fuel represents a much, much higher percentage of a trucker's operating cost than it does a railroad's, a barge, or obviously a pipeline. I think most people get that. What they don't realize is that driver shortage and recruitment is getting to be incredibly problematic. And the best example I can give you is that one of the five largest truckload carriers in the United States actually has more employees involved in recruiting other employees, would-be employees, than it actually does in its sales force. That's the best picture I can paint. And on top of this, we have an hours of service law that has recently started to bite. And the rule now is that one can operate 11 hours in any 14-hour window, but there must be 10 consecutive hours off before and after. And part of this hours of service regulation involves, in theory, much more enforcement of driver logs to make sure that the item I've just read you becomes enforced. But again, like the driver shortage recruitment issue, I think what people don't generally get is that the road congestion, which we now enjoy, those of us who live in D.C. and New York and other major cities, today is a picnic compared to what we're going to see in the next 15 or 20 years. So here is a graphic of truck movements in 1998 with the bandwidth indicating various types of volumes. And this is what the Federal Department of Transportation expects this same network to look like in the year 2020. Now, why is that? This is just truck movements. Well, we have national gridlock coming ahead of us. The lowest trend depicted on this chart, which is in yellow, for those of you who may be colorblind, is the increase in the miles of road. That's the and with 1970 indexed to zero in this chart, and you can see it's not growing very rapidly. The number of citizens in the United States is the next bar up. The licensed drivers are increasing faster than the number of residents because we're more and more auto dependent. The number of registered vehicles that can use the highway is the next item up in red. But vehicle miles traveled is increasing more rapidly than all of the other items. A lot of it has to do with two-income earners, and presumably when we get to 100%, we'll have maxed out on that growth item. Although there are places where people are beginning to work three jobs. I'm a consultant. I know several consultants who actually work in three different cities every week. So we'll see some of that. But anyway, the point is, if this is continuing to grow like this, we got major problems on the highways. And the motor carrier's ability to move any product long distances is going to be compromised. Now, if they're going from North Dakota due south, it may not be a problem. But if they have to pass through Las Vegas, as an example, it's going to be an incredible problem. Now, waterways are a great resource, and America is blessed with a wonderful inland waterway system. The basic problem is it is expensive. There are all kinds of environmental issues, and it's hard to increase the number of miles, even though the Army Corps of Engineers is determined to connect every single state with a major waterway. But the number of miles hasn't really increased very much. I went back and looked, or had my staff look, and the number of miles of navigable channels is essentially unchanged since 1980, and likewise, the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Seaway miles are unchanged. And Katrina had a hell of an impact. It wiped out approximately 400 barges, just as a little aside. So we have problems on the supply side with the barges. I have some maps of oil, gas, and refined product pipelines, but I'm sure Shirley's are more accurate. One note I have down here on the bottom is, just for fun, Shirley, I asked my staff to take the cost of the Alaska pipeline, which I know is the most expensive pipeline per mile, and build me a pipeline from Cedar Rapids to Houston using RW Means to increase it, and we ended up with that. So your figure is $2 billion. The reason I'm bringing it up is I'd be happy to defer to $1 million a mile. But the point is, it can get quite expensive in a hurry. And if you care, I'm bringing it up because if you care to comment later, that's fine. I hope not. But one point is that the railroads will extract and be in a position to extract quite a toll unless the national policy changes to allow pipelines to be more competitive with the rails. This is the national railroad system, and it's somewhat oriented, like Shirley said, the pipelines were to the coast. There is quite a bit of rail infrastructure in the Midwest, however. In fact, the state of Iowa, the last time I checked, had more miles of railroad per square mile than any state in the United States. And the reason for that, in case you're wondering, which I'm sure you are, is that the railroads were basically laid out east-west approximately 10 miles from one another. If you went from the north going to the south, you'd find them going east-west about every 10 miles because a farmer could take his team of horses about 10 miles in a day, so he'd go up to the railhead, dump the grain, park it, leave it with an agent or something, and then go back in a day. And so there was that much infrastructure, and that's why there were a lot of bankrupt railroads in Iowa, by the way. So there are 562 common carrier railroads as of 2006. Railroad industry revenues were about $48 billion. Over 90% of them are privately owned. Most people don't realize that. The Class 1s, which are the major railroads that you hear about, only constitute 1% of the number of railroads, but they represent about two-thirds of the railroad mileage, 90% of its employees, and 93% of the freight revenue. So what you have are a lot of very small feeder railroads called short lines and regional railroads that feed into them, somewhat like United Express feeds into United Airlines. So what's been happening with the railroads? I mean, most people never hear about them. I never see them unless, of course, they're in a hurry to get across a railroad track and the arm goes down and blocks them. But what's been happening, I think, is important to a crowd like this. The number of miles of track is represented in the blue line, which you'll note is decreasing. Frankly, it has decreased since 1929, just about every single year. That was the peak year of railroad mileage. The number of ton miles is increasing, and actually it's been increasing at an increasing rate, and it's due primarily to two things. One, the U.S. is participating much more in international trade, and a lot of that international trade is moving in, obviously, into our ports and is moving in containers as we increasingly containerize freight globally. And that freight and the railroads can handle it because the volumes are so big, really the trucks can't compete on an economics basis. And the other thing is Powder River Basin coal hauled from Wyoming to just about everywhere in the United States is also driving this. So what you have, I combined the demand and supply here and created an index to show you that there's 74% more train miles per mile of track in 2005 than there was in 1991. And this is expensive infrastructure to build. It's probably on average $2 to $3 million a mile if it's in brand new territory. If it's actually within a railroad right of way, it's probably closer to $1 to $1.5 million. It depends very much on the price of steel. Now, there hasn't been a lot of railroad infrastructure investment, and the main reason for that is that the railroad's return on capital, frankly, has been lousy, absolutely lousy. It has not been sufficient for the railroads to earn their cost of capital as an industry in my lifetime. It's improving, but it's not sufficient. One of the things that is... one of the things that is increasing the rates of return is the fact that because the railroads have experienced about 50 mergers in the last 30 years, they now many states are dominated by one railroad. This is a public policy issue we need to come to grips with, and this, I believe, is going to drive the railroads into a position where they will be able to increase their prices. And their returns will go up. Now, hopefully, it'll manifest itself in more infrastructure and not just richer shareholders. But it's the kind of issue we have to deal with. Shirley referred to ethanol plant size. My last count was 106 existing ethanol plants with 54 more under construction. 90% of the existing plants. I have less than 40 million gallons, and I use 40 million gallons because that's a threshold at which I believe the railroads would really be able to be competitive to move that product. But as the plants get larger, and they are rapidly, you hardly see a plan now for less than 100 million gallons, railroad economics are becoming will become much more favorable. Now, in my last three slides, Doug asked me to look into the future, and so this is what my crystal ball looks like. The past cannot be prologue. Concentrated, high-volume biofuels production needs to be thought of as a new type of traffic by the railroad traffic departments and operating departments. The small biofuel shipment volumes historically offer very little useful precedent to the handling of emerging volumes along routes. The key to success will be developing a comprehensive logistical system that basically has three main components: the product terminals at origin, the product terminals at destination, so I'm just mirroring what Shirley said, and also the line haul transportation in between. So what do I mean by a systematic approach? Well, when it comes to railroads, we need unit trains. They are the building block of the logistics systems. Trains need to move between terminals with no change in consist, because that's how you get the fastest velocity, the best turnaround, the best return on investment, et cetera. And terminals, both at origin and destination, need to be designed to accommodate these unit trains. And these terminals have to be designed in such a way as to allow rapid ingress to an egress from the mainline tracks, because if it doesn't, it's just going to screw up everything else that's on the railroad network. So you not only have to have unit train capable terminals, but you have to have them off the main lines using high speed switches, et cetera, all of which costs money. I would say the four items I've read to you so far are required for us to be competitive. In addition, it would be nice if efficient switching could be performed on these terminal tracks, and if technology was put in so that we had rapid loading and unloading of freight cars. So, to summarize, looking forward in the future, in the short term, I do think the rail car fleet is sufficient to keep pace with production and expansion, but I believe destination terminals will be problematic. In the medium term, construction of state-of-the-art destination terminals will be essential, and I think there will be some problems with tank car production capacity. The railroad industry at one time had dozens of people who built railroad cars, but the freight railroad industry was so financially anemic that the the supplier industry really just couldn't deal with the dynamics. I mean, sometimes they would order 60,000 cars in a year. Sometimes they'd order 4,000 cars. It's hard to stay in business when your demand is fluctuating that much. So we have very little rail car production capacity in the United States. It would be a shame to have to import kits from South Korea, but that may be the direction we're headed. So tank car production, I think, is a problem in the medium term. In the long term, I think there are some rail system capacity concerns, but most main routes are capable of expansion. And I think as rail earnings improve, and particularly if there's federal encouragement as manifest in things like the investment tax credit, I think combined we can find enough capacity. It is also, like I said before, essential that unit trains can bypass congested terminals. I believe I had written down, and I guess I'll stick with it, that selective market pipelines could play a role if, in fact, they prove to be feasible. And barges, I'd love to see barges play a large role, but unfortunately, as we've seen, they have relatively limited market reach, and there are issues related to blending near the consumption. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Charles, for a data-packed presentation. What I'd like to do is encourage each of you to maybe write down one or two questions now while this is fresh in your mind, because we're going to come back to a Q&A session at the end. And what we're going to do at this stage is to take a short 10-minute break for coffee or other liquids. So thank you for coming back in a timely manner. So we'll be cognizant of your time as well this morning. So we're going to move on to our third presentation and then into an extended Q&A session. So hopefully you've saved some of your questions and your issues. So we're going to get a slightly different perspective now, kind of going from, I'll call it the steel and the nuts and bolts and the numbers, to really thinking about what the regulatory and policy environment looks like, particularly from the refiner's perspective. And so please join me in welcoming Charles Drevna, who's Executive Vice President of the National Petroleum, Petrochemical and Refiners Association. And we welcome your comments, Charles. So.
Good morning, all. Doug was very kind in his remarks because I know I gave him heartburn when I sent my my presentation over to him. But I wanted to share with you some of the thoughts that we have, and now I'll categorize it as infrastructure because the infrastructure of the refining industry is based upon a lot of things that are outside our refinery gates right now. And I'm talking directly about public policy kinds of things. Excuse me. We're in the business of rearranging hydrocarbon molecules. That's what we do, and I think we do it pretty well. As a matter of fact, and of course the hydrocarbon molecule is under pretty much of attack these days everywhere. I was planning my Halloween costume for next year, and I was going to go as an endangered species, and that would be the hydrocarbon molecule. But I think that as I go through this thing, and believe me, the presentation is intended to solicit some comment and some question, and I welcome those. So let's get started. Government can help you and hurt you, and it can help you and hurt you by either direct or indirect action, and. If you look at some of the things that we're living with as refiners these days, we're looking at what we believe to be, and again, there's categorize it how you want to categorize it. We categorize it as marketplace interference, as inconsistent and punitive tax policy, and we also we're looking at now what we call price gouging legislation. And if anyone can define price gouging, please run up to the Hill and let them know what it is. I'm going to talk a little bit about the scope and timing of some regulatory requirements, and then also government inaction. And I would suggest that government inaction over the years, in spite of E-Pact 05, is failure to enact comprehensive energy legislation. What can I add to that? Not much. So, this is the era we find ourselves in these days, especially as refiners. So let's talk about these renewable fuel mandates. And, you know, I have to preface my remarks, and I've got a new director of communications, and he chided me the other day. We were leaving, where the hell were we? We were leaving ABC News, and I was doing an interview over there, and he said, "Charlie, you can't say we don't oppose." He said, "You got to say you support with limitations, but, you know, so any event, if I say we don't oppose, just in your minds transcribe that, because I've been saying it for so long." Now, really seriously, ethanol and biofuels, they are going to play a vital role on a going forward basis in the supply system and for transportation fuels. We believe, though, the whole mechanism falls apart when politics trump prudent policy, and we've seen a lot of that. And I have to tell you, I think there should be a congressional, some legislative action that outlaws the use of the term energy independence. It is a myth. I think it does a disservice to the average citizen of the country to even talk about it. For crying out loud, Saudi Arabia is not energy independent. So unless we come up with the matter antimatter thing here, we're not going to be energy independent ever. Now, we can do things to increase our security, and I think we'll talk a little bit about that as we go along. One thing I want to stress, though, and Shirley talked about it somewhat, but I want to really emphasize it. You know, it's one thing to have a mandate that we don't agree with and we don't think is necessary, and there I talk about the RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standard. But when you superimpose on that individual state biofuels, ethanol, biodiesel, whatever mandates, that can really interfere with the efficient transportation system of fuels. I like to say Shirley touched on it, but you look at some of the map of the pipeline that she showed, and if you're going up through the Midwest and you're delivering a conventional gasoline to some state, and then the state next to it says, "Oh, but we want an E10 blend." And the next state says, "We want an E20 blend." And the next state says, "Well, we want a biodiesel." Those are four different batches of fuel the Shirley's members have to ship for us. And four different kinds of activities at the end that have to be implemented in order to provide a commercial grade fuel. It's just fraught with potential consequences, and we say it's going to interfere with the RFS implementation program. Now, ethanol does have a bright future with or without E-Pact. It does increase octane. It helps on RFG requirements, some CO benefits, and the big thing we believe it extends the fuel supply. It's wet. We need wet. We are gasoline short in the country. The supply again is way below demand. The demand that continues to increase is, I think, it's up about 2% this year already for gasoline. I mean, so people are still driving their SUVs, and people are still about 85% of us drive back and forth to work. There's really no other choice. But so we do need it, and it will play a vital role. But it also has some trade-offs. It has a lower energy content, has a higher reed vapor pressure, it can exacerbate ozone non-attainment, and as the two previous speakers, has transportation and logistical limitations. So before we rush off and have some sort of ethanol, biodiesel massive mandate, and again I'll get into that, we got to really think about what this means. So, to start with, let's talk about what an E10 mandate means. Let me go back. An E10 mandate would signify we have 149 refineries in the nation and over 1,500 terminals. While an E10 mandate means that as gasoline's about 15, you know, a billion gallons right now a year, we would have an E10 would be 15 billion gallons of ethanol. Well, that means every terminal in the country would have to have ethanol blending capability, all 1,500 of them. And it's going to have to be a way to get the ethanol to 1,500 terminals. Can it be done? Sure. Can it be done? You got enough money, you can do anything. Should it be done? I think that's the question we have to answer, you know. And heretofore, the answer has been we need to do it because of energy security. Well, I think people are starting to take a long, hard look at that. I hope they are. Now, the other thing we hear about is the next thing that's going to save us is E85. Now, I think if you don't know, let me explain real briefly. Right now, we have a fleet of automobiles out there that can handle up to E10 without any problems, other than mileage penalties. If you go E11, E12, E13, doesn't sound like you're going a heck of a lot higher. Can't do it because the warranty, the automobile manufacturers won't warranty anything over E10 right now. Now they're working to try to get some things done, but again, it's technology that isn't there yet. So you have to go to E85, which is 85% ethanol, 15% gasoline, and you have to have an alternate fueled vehicle to be an AFV to do that. Now there aren't that many out in the road these days. You know, less than 1% of all ethanol consumption is E85. Now, the infrastructure. This is where I did do my homework. Right, there. This is the infrastructure that has not been built to store, transport, and retail E85. There has been real no studies of E85 use. As a matter of fact, the Underwriters Laboratory just took away the certification for some pumps at retail. And that gives the marketers some heartburn, as you could imagine. Now, the wonderful thing though about E85 is or FFVs, flexible fuel vehicles, the auto makers can claim the fuel economy credit by just building the car and selling it. Now that car may never see E85. It will run on gasoline very, very well. As a matter of fact, it'll run on gasoline better because you're going to get about a third better mileage out of it. But just selling it gives them the fuel credits they need. Now, is that the public policy we should be striving for in this country? I'll let you answer that. The other thing is, again, an infrastructure question or comment. There's been talk that refiners who are marketers and marketers should be mandated to have E85 pumps under our canopies, or we should pay for its infrastructure. Well, again, I go back to say that our business is the rearrangement of hydrocarbon molecules and delivery to the driving public. We're not opposed to E85. And if a retailer, whether it's a major well-known marketer or a private independent, you want to put an E85 pump in your station, you feel free to do it. But we shouldn't be required to do it. And of course, the autos will tell us they told the committee last week that I testified up in Rick Boucher's Energy and Air Quality Subcommittee on Energy and Commerce that they're going to be doubling the production of FFVs in the next 4 to 5 years. Wow. It's still going to be less than needed to get critical mass for anybody to put these kind of make these investments in any station. Now, I did suggest that if the autos want to put these pumps at their dealerships, what a deal. Go ahead. I know my members would be more than willing to supply the 15% gasoline they need to blend it. But again, these are public policy issues that directly impact infrastructure, and what the refining industry has to do. Now, from the administration, and this really, I think when I read these two things a couple of months ago, I was taken aback. And I'm going to read this one. It looks like I misspelled Greenwire, but that's all right. National security concerns have forced the Bush administration to rethink its free market philosophies on energy issues. What does that mean? And Al Hubbard said, the president concluded that there are other factors that require us to intrude in this marketplace. What does that mean? Does that mean for every other commodity in the nation, pork bellies, orange juice, that's okay to have a free market, but for transportation fuels, the federal government's going to tell us who, what, when, where, and how? So back in January 23rd, President Bush announced his goals in the State of the Union address, and just this week we had the big press conference from the Rose Garden, and of course DOE and DOT and EPA were all involved. Now the president has asked the nation to reduce gasoline demand by 20% in 10 years, come up with an RFS renewables of 35 billion gallons, and that can include hydrogen, coal to liquids, other alternatives. And again, he has sent a formal package to Congress. Bear with me a moment here as we do the regression from 2017 at a 20% reduction in the use of gasoline. To what does that mean to the refining industry? So, okay, let's cycle back in time. 2 years ago, EPACT 05, I don't know how many times we were up testifying about the need for additional refinery capacity. We can't keep up with the demand, even though over the past 10 to 12 years on the aggregate, the domestic refining industry has added the equivalent of one world-class refinery per year for the past 10 to 12 years. At expansion at existing facilities. Now, yes, have any new refineries been built? No. Since 1976, I think it was the last one, Garyville, down in Louisiana, Marathon's. But that begs the question, have we been expanding capacity? The answer is an unequivocal yes. At the same time, we were hit with ultra-low sulfur diesel and tier 2 sulfur and gasoline. Reformulated gasoline, all these things that required major investments, we were still able to expand capacity. 2 years ago, 1 year ago, if you would have asked 435 congressmen and 100 senators, I would suggest that 95% plus would have said, yes, we want you to increase capacity at existing facilities. We need more product getting out there to the American consumer. Our guys announced a 1.5 a million barrel a day capacity expansion intention, not commitment, intention, and people were running their numbers. But funny thing happened along the way to that 1.5 million barrels a day. Well, let me digress a minute too. We're the refining industry, and we report in millions, thousands of barrels, or millions of barrels. The ethanol industry reports in millions of gallons per year. We report in barrels per day. They report in gallons per year. So I just want to give you a flavor of what we're dealing with here. So let's go to 20% reduction. EIA suggests that in a 20% reduction in gasoline use in 2017 would be equal to less gasoline production than we have today in 2007. Let me repeat that. The president wants a 20% reduction in gasoline use in 2017. Using EIA estimates, that equals less gasoline produced in the United States by domestic refiners in 2017 than we are doing today. Now, put your refining executive hats on, and you're sitting in your boardroom, and you're looking at a $1 billion investment on capacity expansion. Now, what prudent CEO or CFO or refinery manager is not going to take a long, hard look at that expansion and say, ooh, wait a minute, what are we doing here? We are going to put billions of dollars of capital into capacity that we're not going to be able, we're not allowed to use. Now, the question has to be the $35 billion. Now, there's a lot of ifs that go into the $35 billion. If we have cellulosic technology, if we can do this, if we can, there was the one I love is from my friends in the ethanol industry. We're going to have a virtual pipeline. Shirley, do you guys have virtual pipelines? So I think let's ground the debate in reality for change, please. So you know, again, one can only suggest that my members or my guys and ladies are doing a long, hard look at capacity expansions these days. So before we collectively abandon hydrocarbons and stock up on carbohydrates, you know, let's make sure we understand the proper role for these things. Okay, that's all we're asking. We're not. No, I almost said we're not opposed. No, we support. We support the increased use of biofuels. But they're not the panacea to our energy supply problems. They're not going to deliver that. I'm not even going to read that one. I can't even bring myself to say those words anymore. And you know, we are. Being on the politically correct side of ethanol is the thing to do these days. I mean, it just has been. But as I say, you know, they may be intoxicated by the political allure, but the rest of the country is going to wake up with the economic hangover if we don't do this thing right. So. Are we in overdrive with ethanol politics? We got state and federal politicians. That's the panacea. Now we got the 2008 primaries coming up. Hold your horses. So we're going to troop through Iowa. We're going to worship at the altar of ethanol, and who knows what positions we're going to come up with. So we're not. Like I say, we may be addicted to oil, but we're also addicted to the politics of ethanol. And I went through this one already about the reduction in gasoline. We testified, at the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee on the transportation conference on February 1, and you saw how effective that was. They came out with their 35 billion gallon bill, and I testified last week, and that was a good hearing last week. There were some good questions asked from both sides of the aisle about where we're going. This was Rick Boucher's subcommittee. Why don't you read that one? Voltaire, he was a pretty smart fellow, from what I recall, from my philosophy days. So I'm not making this stuff up. So, you know, the implementation of the current RFS, you know, EPA promulgated their final rules on this thing just back on May 1st. And we sponsored a conference just a couple of days ago with EPA, the ethanol industry, how this thing is going to work. Now, the RFS program is going to begin this year, September 1st. It hadn't started yet, really. I mean, we've been using more ethanol than the mandate calls for because the market suggested we should. We didn't need to have Congress tell us some, but in any event, it hasn't even started, and they're talking about expanding it. Let me shift gears a little bit because all this comes into play. I mean, refiners have to make decisions today on what they think the future is going to look like. Right? We can't make decisions every based on election cycles. So we had the 100-hour blitz from Speaker Pelosi back in early January, and it repealed some of the tax benefits that were quote bestowed upon some of the refiners. We're also hearing, the repeal of LIFO for oil, gas, and refining, the elimination of the expensing provision, which allows us to expense 50% of our of our cost if we increase capacity by 5% or more. I want to talk about reimposition of Superfund taxes and of course, the ever-popular windfall profits tax. You know, it's bad enough that they're going to try to do this. They want to take the money and give it to renewable fuels. Let me back up. I think that's what he meant. But no surprise, we're fighting these things. We're going to give it a shot.
Does that mean you're not supporting it?
Yeah, that is true, Charles. That is true. That one, my director of communication is saying, we are not supporting any of those. Now comes the ever-popular price gouging legislation. You know, I mean, I would suggest, you know, first of all, no, you know, if anyone knows what price gouging is, please let us know so we can take that definition up to the Hill, so we can at least agree on something. I think it's that old you'll know it when you see it thing that the other Supreme Court justice talked about some other issue. But the reality is that, you know, fuel prices serve as signals to either increase or decrease supplies. This holds true whether, you know, in times of crisis or normal operations. You know, markets can be efficient when allowed to move based upon supply signals, real signals. But what, again, if you're a refinery manager and you're under, you know, even a little bit of concern, because these bills have severe economic and criminal penalties attached with them. So, I mean, you don't want your card on your refinery or your company card, you don't want to say vice president of going to jail. And you'd be the designated guy there. And we've been through this. You know, history will tell us that price caps will result in shortages, because imagine what would have happened in the aftermath of Katrina and Rita, when naturally the signal to the market said prices go up. Imports increased by over 50%, thank goodness. Now, but if you're standing at the refinery, you're ready to push that send button to put it into Shirley's pipelines that were up and running in very short order after that hurricane, I might add, due to a lot of good work by a lot of good people, you know, you're going to say, gee, do I send this stuff or not? Because I don't know what price gouging is. Hey, has the price risen dramatically? Sure it has. Am I gouging? Don't know. And I think again, any prudent person is going to err on the side of caution. They don't get that. We did this through the 70s. Again, it's difficult to define. It's vague policy. Charles, we don't support that either.
I'm saying it so you wouldn't.
this is a chart that I think I'm not allowed to take up on the Hill anymore. They don't want to see it up there. But I think it's a good chart to show you what's some of the cumulative regulatory impacts from, you know, on refineries 2002 through 10. You know, the red indicate what we have to do at the refinery, and the blue indicates what we have to do actually with the fuel. And I mean, they're pancaked, you know, on top of each other. These are very costly, very expensive things. But I'm going to skip over that. Because one of the things I want to talk about, you know, again, government actions. What happens? What can't happen? We are going through the process now, reviewing the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. EPA, because they were sued, they had to do it. Now, the 1997 standards have yet to be implemented. 0.08, you know, court ruling. EPA was sued. They have to come up with something different, or they have to at least address the issue. So the regs are going to be proposed any day now. Within the next couple of months, I should say. Both KSAC and EPA, we've heard they want to lower that to 0.07 or 0.06, and the result being this. If you look at the red, that's the current non-attainment counties in the United States. If you look at the blue, that's at 0.07 ppm, and the green, the addition, and these are cumulative now, remember. So the whole nation is going to be non-attainment. Now, what does that mean? That means if you want to operate a business in that area, you're not going to do it. It's just no new businesses are going to those areas. So, and of course, if you look again, look at where Shirley's map was of where the refineries are around the country. What a coincidence. You know, we're in all those areas. So, and they want us to expand. Okay. Now, there's also government inaction. And I say this sincerely. We have failed to enact real national energy policy in this country. We talk about it, you know, but every time we talk about it, it ends up being talked about in a farm bill, in an environmental bill, in a transportation bill, in a props bill, or a tax bill, or some other, or the importation of Swedish hockey sticks bill. I don't know. It's just it isn't talked about in an energy bill. So that's what we're asking. Let's have an honest, open debate about where we have to go, how we're going to get there. And all these things are going to play a role. Again, we support the use of biofuels. We support them in the marketplace. We support letting the marketplace allow where they have to go. And again, on an infrastructure kind of issue, if you look at all those ethanol plants that Charles talked about being built and all the ones that are in the queue, the theory is, as more of these plants come online, there will be supposedly more ethanol in the system. Therefore, the price of ethanol should shrink a little bit. Well, that's maybe good news to the consumer, but it sure as all heck is bad news to that ethanol producer who is leveraged to the hilt. So what's going to happen? The more ethanol plants we build, margins shrink. They're going to come right back to Congress and say, we need a bigger mandate because those prices have to rise. And it's just going to be on and on and on. Again, we have to sit down and think about what national energy policy means. I didn't do this. He was a pretty smart guy, too, so I didn't think of this. This is... this is one of my favorite slides. I use this everywhere I go, so please bear with me. Supply is the myths that we believe impact public policy decisions. Supply is always available at low prices. Environmental improvements are free. Alternate fuels are cheap and abundant, and unlike fossil fuels, those require no environmental trade-offs. Well, I think there's a thing called the one-pound waiver. Just one little thing out there that may have a little impact on that. You know, the consumers are always willing to pay higher prices for better environmental performance until somebody sticks a microphone in front of them at a service station and starts asking about prices. The little or no progress has been made in reducing air quality and emissions and general improvements in the environment, and that the oil and petrochemical industries pay little attention to environmental health and safety improvements. These are out there. They're a myth. I believe they're wrong. But they do drive public policy. So we are going to be continually relying upon petroleum products for this decade and well into the next, and probably the next and the next. The question is, can we sit around the table in an intellectually honest way? I mean, politics are always going to be part of the deal. We're not naive. We understand that. But can we sit around in an intellectually honest way and talk about what we need to do? And, I mean, the policymakers are going to have to accept the fact that, you know, hydrocarbon energy is here to stay for a long while, and we need it for economic growth. Now, that's what I'm going to read to you. Politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it everywhere, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedies. Now, who said this? Anyone know? If I told you Marx, would you think Marx? Well, it was a Marx. It was Groucho Marx. Another bright man. That's it, guys and ladies. I'm more than happy to sit down and have your questions lobbed at me. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the informative and provocative thoughts, kind of a turn toward the political and regulatory climate. So We're going to open the floor to questions and answers. We do have roaming microphones. I ask for you to please follow two guidelines. The first is to state your name and your affiliation, and the second is to ask a question as a question, please. And we'll open the floor. We have a bit of time, and feel free to indulge us in a couple of details. So, who would like to start us off? Alex.
Hi. I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consulting engineer. Do people have some ranges of values or rules of thumb for how much it costs to move a gallon of ethanol a mile with the various ways of doing it, with trucks or railroads or pipelines?
I think EPR Inc., the old Peer Inc., but now it's EPR, whatever they call themselves, with Larry Goldstein's group and Lou Puglisi's group, they did a paper, and they just compared the cost of moving a gallon of gasoline by pipeline. I think it was, and on again, this is average aggregate, maybe 2 to 3 cents a gallon, and the cost of moving ethanol, not by pipeline because it's not moved that way, but by truck is like 18 to 19 cents a gallon.
No, it's not a gallon mile, though. I mean, it's really based on distance.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's hard to say. I mean, it's a few cents to move from the Gulf Coast up into this part of the country, maybe 5 cents, depending on you know various circumstances. But there's no question that pipeline transportation for long distances is far less expensive than the other modes of transport.
For long distances and large volumes,
I think it would be
pipeline would be the cheapest, and then barges would be the next cheapest. If you could reach, the destination, because you have to start transloading the material, it adds a lot of costs. I would say if the volumes and distances were great enough, rail would then be the cheapest, and trucks would be significantly at variance from the first three, higher. I don't have the numbers, but it would be significantly more expensive.
It's a function of distance. It's not just a function of, the transportation mode. But the per mile cost goes down dramatically for longer distances with some modes like pipelines, for example.
Any idea of ranges? Like 1 cent, 10 cents?
I'm sorry. The question, again, was the asking for the cost per gallon mile by different transportation modes, or a range?
No, I don't think we have that.
Go ahead, Alex. If you just want to kind of work across the front row, that would work.
My name is Kevin Coates. I write about energy and transportation issues. Question for Mr. Drebna. I have to take the bait of the price gouging. I just can't sit here and watch this. And the thing that comes to mind for me is when I look at the price of a barrel of oil on any given day, and we're talking futures, we're talking, let's say now it's May, we're talking about July futures for the price of a barrel of oil. And if it spikes up, gas stations raise their prices in reaction to that news. Now, they're buying oil that was sent to them in the past, where they paid, who knows what they paid for it. And my point is that it seems to be an inconsistent behavior between what the retailers are selling at the pump based upon what the oil companies are buying the oil for. Can you shed some light on all this?
Yeah, I believe when I'm not a retailer, but I believe when the price of crude goes up, the retailer looks at that, and that's his cost of replacement that day. No matter what he's purchased in the back, he has to base upon his replacement costs that day. So and usually there's a little bit of a lag. So you hear the statement, up like a rocket, down like a feather. But basically it's because of replacement costs. They have to base what they're doing on that day for the future.
My question is for Shirley. I'm Claire Cambridge, Argus Media. It involves the certification of E85 pumps. And could you perhaps describe why the National Underwriters Laboratory is stalled in its certification of these E85 pumps and the broader sort of ethanol infrastructure implications around that?
Well, I really can't speak to that. The pipeline association, the pipelines that I represent are interstate pipelines. They don't engage in retail distribution. I've talked to the folks from UL, and I know they're working on it, but it's not something that our association has any direct involvement with.
We don't have any direct involvement with it either, although we've been accused of it. But I understand it's just a question of safety with seals and things like that, and there are some very strict standards that when you're dispensing a very flammable product you have to meet, and apparently there's been a problem with seals and gaskets and things like that, and that just didn't meet the UL seal, underwriter's seal of approval. I saw somebody in the back had there, maybe was going to answer that question. Probably hell. Oh, I'm sorry. That's what the thing is, and these things have to go through a pretty rigorous safety and inspections on any number of issues. Now I understand they are working on it, and there have been there are E85 pumps scattered throughout the country. I haven't heard of any major problems with those, but apparently UL found something that just didn't meet their criteria.
Richard Wallace, I'm retired from Texaco. Wondered if, for Mr. Drevna, do you feel your association knows what Senator McCain's position is on ethanol? I'm not asking you to define it or state it, but in your plea, it seemed the plea of your presentation was to have good government policy and an honest conversation, and so I just wondered if you felt you had a clear idea where he stood on more ethanol and the current Bush mandates.
I really don't know right now. I know in the past the senator had some, and I don't want to use the word problems, had some issues, some questions about where we were going on ethanol. I can't speak for the senator or his staff, but he's a presidential candidate, and I'm sure he has opinions. But we haven't spoken directly with the senator for a while about it.
Thanks. I'm Carmen DeFilio from the Department of Energy. And question for Charlie. I noticed your map still had some white on it for the ozone non-attainment under the different proposals.
Right.
And I was wondering, are there any ozone monitors in those white areas?
That's a good question, Carmen. I imagine there are, but I think if you look at it, it's got to be most of the rural areas that have no, I mean.
Well, I mean, there's a possibility that the levels are being set so close to ambient, so close to background, that if they did put monitors in those white areas, they may be non-attainment.
That,
well.
Carmen, that's a heck of a good observation. I would, so what you're suggesting is the whole damn country's going to be in non-attainment.
It's possible.
If they go to 0.06, I wouldn't doubt it. Good observation.
I'm Dan Cohn from MIT. I have a question for Mr. Drevna. You mentioned the need for a more rational energy policy. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? And in particular, could you mention what perspective you have on more efficient vehicles?
you know, efficiency has to play a role, whether it's in vehicles, refrigerators, or, you know, whatever you, whatever you're doing these days. I think you start with, you know, any rational policy has to start with that. You know, we're seeing, you know, we're replacing light bulbs, even though homemakers don't like them for whatever reason. But no, you're right. You have to start with that. Now, but that's the, and again, that that just goes to indicate that there isn't one single silver bullet out there that's going to solve our problems. Biofuels are going to play a huge role. The question is, what role? The other thing that we've always touted as NPRA is we suggest that we are a supply side oriented trade group. Now, just take natural gas for example. I've categorized it as sort of two opposing or conflicting public policies. Here we come up with, we as a nation come up with environmental laws and regulation that are fine. Once you sit down and argue and fight, win, lose, you move on, you do it. But the way the regulations and the laws have been promulgated, there's this inexorable push to force, for example, utilities to switch to natural gas because it's the cheapest thing for them to do. Well, cheapest, they can call up their local PUC and say, hey, pass this on. But what does that do to people who depend on natural gas as a feedstock, like their side of my family, the petrochemical side? So we're pushing more and more usage of natural gas, but we're still, other than a very, very modest thing we saw last year at the end of the 109th Congress that opens up a small portion of Section 181. Matter of fact, I call it Section 60 and a third because it's only about a third of what the whole thing is that you can explore. We've got natural gas and oil locked up on both coasts that we can't get to because of the moratoria. But we're talking about bringing in LNG from foreign sources. In one hand, we're saying we need to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And then the same thing, we're saying we need to increase our dependence on LNG from foreign places. I just say that's conflicting, or you know, it just doesn't work. It doesn't pass the rationale test. So you know, we're starting. I mean, will these moratoria areas be opened up? In the 110th or 111th call? I doubt it. However, I think there are, and again, I'm not saying this is not a partisan issue. It doesn't matter if you have an R or a D on your sweatshirt. There are people on both sides of the political spectrum who don't want those sources opened up. And I think when you pass a bill in a resolution in the House last 2 years ago that said we forbid you to even categorize what's out there. We don't even want you to go out there and figure out what's out there. Is that sound energy policy? So we're just saying, you know, let's talk about opening up some of these offshore things. I mean, we don't have the technology that we used in the 50s and the 60s. We've got some pretty sophisticated technology these days that can go in there and explore and leave little or no environmental footprint. I mean, look what happened after Katrina and Rita. I mean, we had platforms just blown over in the Gulf with little or no environmental impact because we know how to do things better these days. So what we're saying is, you know, let's be consistent in our message.
Ed Yarbrough with Honeywell, representing UOP in our aerospace sector. A question really for the panel. Maybe everybody would like to comment on this. We've been concentrating on ethanol-based and such. What happens if the legislation and things of that nature go more or less alternate fuel agnostic? So you get such things as the Fischer-Tropsch gas and coal to liquid. You get lignocellulosic. You get the paraffinic kinds of things that are a little bit more chemically like the petrochemicals. I mean, how does that alter the transportation through a wide variety of means, and how does the refinery capacity change or have to alter to handle those kinds of fuels?
Good question.
We actually have been approached by various interests who are looking at CTL facilities, coal to liquids, to produce Fischer-Tropsch diesel. I don't know where any of those things stand, but certainly that's a product that could be batched in a multi-product pipeline. Biodiesel raises some other questions. Of course, there's not a clear standard for biodiesel, and there are all sorts of different formulations that are called biodiesel. One of the problems, or one of the, I guess it's a problem, that a multi-product pipeline has to contend with is maintaining the purity of different batches. And between different batches of fuel, even if there's some sort of a, a plug between the batches, you wind up with a certain amount of transmix or the possibility for trail back. And because of the need for very pure jet fuel, companies are doing some experiments now with batching biodiesel, but that trail back issue is a concern. So they're, we're trying to figure out how to manage that sort of thing. I mean, some of the companies are looking at that. Certainly, the limit. We don't know what the limits are. I mean, with respect to these alternative fuels, there are all sorts of new formulations for biodiesel. And, in fact, I'm surprised Charlie didn't mention the fact that some of his companies were successful in lobbying the Internal Revenue Service to expand the biodiesel credit to something called renewable diesel that involves putting biomass feedstock directly into a refinery, a conventional refinery.
Good segue, Shirley. That's true. I mean, but unfortunately, the National Biodiesel Board went up there and complained that it had happened. Our position on it is that, any of these policies that emanate from Congress or the administration, they should be technology and feedstock and neutral. They shouldn't be out there picking winners and losers. Because if you pick winners and losers, you're just going to inhibit innovation. You're going to, and I could say we're pretty good at what we do, in spite of some of the things that are written about us in the papers these days. And we know how to run refineries. But if you say, you can only do biodiesel or renewable diesel at the back end of the refinery. And you as a refiner aren't eligible to use your innovation and your technology and your smarts and your capital to be technology and feedstock neutral. Again, I go back to that just eliminates the open and honest discussion that I pleaded for up there. So that's all we're asking. I'll use it to level playing field.
Yeah, let me follow on to your question just with a little bit further one, because if you look at CTL and you look at the coal resources in the U.S. predominantly, and you look where perhaps those production facilities might reside, given the fact that coal on the rail lines is already a fairly significant driver of rail capacity. Charles, I'll talk to you on this one. And you kind of reflect back, and I'm not sure if you have the map in your head, but if you look at the rail map that was put up there, in fact, let me pose this question. It's relatively sparse in through the, I'll call it the Rocky Mountain region, and particularly in Wyoming. And so the question would be, given the specificity of the rail line and the density, where are the critical choke points? Are there critical choke points, and where are they, and how might they be addressed?
Well, the critical choke points really do change from, if you look at it in five-year blocks, the critical choke points do change. And a little bit like the way Charlie was saying, the refiners are looking at, 2017, and what should they do? I mean, because the rail industry has underperformed from a financial perspective, since it hasn't earned its cost of capital in decades. The boards have been reluctant to invest in any infrastructure unless the returns on investment were 40, 45, 50% return on investment, because they don't have enough capital to invest you know, working your way down through the projects every year. I worked in capital budgeting in two railroads, and I know it seems ridiculous to cut off at 48% as your hurdle rate, but if you're not earning enough money, you can't go very far down that list. There are some choke points. In fact, in the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, the Union Pacific and Burlington Northern, which operate essentially jointly in that territory, have been adding additional track. I think they have a program to add, I think, 100 miles of additional track in Wyoming. The real problems are at the originating and terminating points. But there are many places, and not many, but there are a few places in the United States now where there are triple and quadruple tracks. In the central Nebraska, where the Union Pacific takes the Powder River coal, its Powder River coal, east and south, there is a train every 15 minutes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The specifics of a choke point, I think Wyoming is an issue, no question about it, but there are, in fact, at the moment, two initiatives underway just to serve the Powder River Basin. The federal government recently turned down a loan request from a railroad called the Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad that wanted to, in fact, not just add capacity, but in fact add competition building into the Powder River Basin. It's an existing railroad that's a couple hundred miles away. The federal government refused to give them essentially a below-market loan to finance it. Whether they'll be successful in the private markets, I don't know. I just don't know. And there is a second initiative underway, which is more modest, which is called the Tongue River Railroad, which would save something like 150 miles for the Burlington Northern for all the coal that it could move north. Most of the coal that comes out of the Powder River Basin goes immediately south. Some of it goes to the north, and some of it even goes towards the Pacific Northwestern ports, cities. But this would save 150 miles, which, you know, would help reduce the cost. But obviously, if coal gasification goes big time in a hurry, there will be constraints. But the biggest problem is not so much handling a particular volume. It's the combination. It's the way the rail industry operates. It essentially operates at four different speeds. It operates passenger trains the fastest, intermodal trains the next fastest, bulk trains like grain and coal unit trains, they operate only at about 25 to 30 miles an hour. And the real capacity chewer is the differential between intermodal and passenger at 79 miles an hour and coal and grain at 20 to 30 miles an hour. That's what chews up a lot of capacity. If everything operated at the same speed, it would – and I keep making this argument to financial people in the rail industry that they're pushing so strong on the intermodal business – and I think their profitability is improving. I don't think it's particularly profitable at the moment, but it's a great story for Wall Street. But the problem is it chews up a tremendous amount of capacity, particularly on a single track. It takes hundreds of miles if two trains are moving in the same direction on a single track. It takes a long time. It chews up a lot of capacity. I'm not explaining it very well. If a faster train in the back is trying to pass slower train in the front, it is very difficult. And unlike the pipeline system, you do not have a particular place where train B passes train A. You have to kind of set it out. Every 40 miles or something, you build a couple mile long spur so that one train can overtake the other one. And if the railroads were more disciplined in their operations, then it would be much more cost-effective for everyone, and that's an area I hope that they will continue to make progress on. But at the moment, and short of building a double track everywhere, there are going to be all kinds of financial problems.
Could I just comment on that, though, Doug? You just focused on the West. I think what I'm hearing from members of Congress is that there's interest in CTL in the Appalachian region. And, you know, we were talking about the cost of constructing pipelines. You know, if you're trying to build infrastructure in a heavily mountainous area, the costs are that much higher. And there seems to be a lot of interest in that part of the country, not just in the West. And that poses all sorts of additional challenges, because I'm not sure how much rail capacity there is there already.
Well, actually, I think there probably is pretty good capacity in a lot of that territory, because the Powder River Basin coal has displaced the eastern coal fields. So I think there probably is infrastructure. Now, if you have to build a lot more, it clearly is expensive to go up a hill, and it's also expensive to operate up a hill. But I think that there probably could be a pretty good mix there. Match, I mean.
I have more questions, but I don't want to preempt the audience here, so please.
A little bit further on the CTL discussion, I think the interest would be in the east because of the high sulfur coal would be more appropriate for a CTL where the sulfur is not an issue. And I think I agree with the point that that would be an area. I don't think there's anything about infrastructure that's going to stop CTL. It's really the concern over greenhouse gas policies. I think if greenhouse gas policy, if somehow we discovered tomorrow that the climate change was an error and that we're not doing anything to contribute to climate change, CTL would clearly have a great future.
Alex, in the front.
Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment about that great chart that Mr. Banks had up there with the increase in road capacity, was it? And then you had population, and then the last one was the, what was it, miles traveled?
Vehicle mile traveled.
Vehicle miles traveled. And I've studied this and looked at it in some detail, and the conclusion I've come up with is that, and the Texas, was it Texas Tech Transportation
Institute
study? Yeah. They were looking at the vehicle miles traveled and how things have almost doubled in, 20 years. And what I've been noticing is that it's because of cheap, affordable housing further and further out from city centers, which is driving this fuel consumption. It's not the SUVs. So to go to Mr. Drevna's comment about an energy policy, you can't have an energy policy unless you consider your housing policy and you look at your transportation policy. All three are interrelated, and we're not, as a country, looking at this. Now, anybody want to make any comments on that?
Well, I've been teaching an energy policy class for a while now, and I finally started out my very first lecture putting up a chart showing all of the different, just in the United States, all of the different laws and statutes and disciplines that deal with or have an impact on energy policy. You're right, transportation, you know, zoning issues, environmental policies, water policies. There are a whole host of issues. There's also the fact that we, at the federal level, we don't have a lot of jurisdiction over the energy sector. And the utilities are most heavily regulated at the local level. There are more munis than anything. And a lot of the infrastructure, both oil and gas, is regulated at different levels, and a lot of it's not regulated. It's dependent on the investment decisions of individuals. So it's very difficult to have a national energy policy. And with all due respect to Charlie and all my other colleagues here in Washington that constantly talk about the need for a national energy policy, as somebody who spent many years in the middle of trying to figure out how to make that happen, it's very difficult with our form of government and the history of the development of the energy sector in this country. I mean, the U.S. is a one-off in the world. From the standpoint of the way the system developed. And it's not as simple as everyone would like to believe.
Surely I comment on that. I agree. You know, we are diverse. I mean, it's you know, we're huge country. But if we can't agree on a national energy policy, or even if something like that would ever exist, I think let's at least agree on the fact that maybe we all should take the Hippocratic Oath and first do no harm.
Good way to think about it.
Join in. I remember in ninth or tenth grade, I was privileged at the high school I went here in Washington to hear a, I think it was a Greek city planner named Constantine Doxiadis. And he had this concept for how cities should develop, but basically in cores, and they wouldn't let them get physically too big, and basically circles. And you'd have green lands outside so that people could actually walk to the parks, you know, sort of like the green belt concept, you know. And then to have, you know, heavy-duty transportation linking these nodes, if you will, up. And well, he wasn't that specific, but presumably highway, rail, pipeline, everything. You need everything. But I personally think that you're absolutely right about housing. Every single person who works in – I'm literally across the street. Every single person in my office except me takes the subway to work. And we're moving. Our building is being torn down because it's only 7 years old, you know, and they can make more money if they tear it down again. So so they're building, and I think I'm going to lose my young employees because – my youngest one has just moved basically to the intersection of I-66 and I-81. He just got married a lovely lady. He's not telling me, but I presume they'd like to have some children, and the only way they can afford to have a place together is to live that far out. Now, he's getting up at I don't know what time, about a few minutes after he gets home, and gets back on a bus and takes the bus in and then comes downtown. It's crazy, and you're right. It's he happens because he's in the transportation business, and we do a lot of passenger rail work as well. You know, he is influenced, obviously, and biased in that direction, and the nature of our work, he can work on the bus. But we have to do something to tie housing together. You're absolutely right with transportation. The problem is that, I mean, you and I may think we know what the solution is, but these two people may feel that that's not what America is about, you know? You know, policy is one thing, but the fact of the matter is individuals, you know, the role of the individual in the United States is a one-off, I think, is what really Shirley was saying. And getting people to act that way is tough. I mean, a really good example is right here in Northern Virginia. There is an effort underway to really densify the stations around Metro Rail. Right. If you go to Sweden and you take a commuter train out of Stockholm, when you get to a station, and certainly a terminal, I mean, the end station, there is a gas station, a grocery store, a place to drop off your children for daycare, a dry cleaner. I mean, everything that normal people need in the course of their an average day is there. You walk through there, you get your day done, you go to the parking lot, and you drive home. You know, it's so obvious that that's what we need to have. But you try telling that to people who live next door to the Vienna Metro station, you're going to get a little bit of a fight. But so I think that's really where we need to focus. But I agree, housing and transportation is idiotic not to marry them up.
Let me provide one more techno-economic comment on that one. NREL, actually, the National Renewable Energy Lab, has a small effort working with community developers to create renewable communities where they're trying to integrate in not only smart transportation, green fields, but also clean power as well as alternative transportation mode like plug-in electric vehicles. There are a couple of pilot projects in the pipeline, and I encourage you to look those up on our website. Let me flip back the discussion relative to the institution in which we are sitting and ask perhaps one final question before we have some final comments and remarks from Eric Peterson, which is, what does the international infrastructure look like for biofuels? And maybe it's too nascent at this stage to describe it as it is, but what might it look like in a couple of different scenarios, shall we say, with increased production from Latin America, particularly Brazil, perhaps increased production from India and Africa on the diesel front and perhaps also ethanol front, and you can pontificate with or in the absence of a tariff regime. I'll open up the policy perspective there as well. So comments?
Well, if we're talking about importing product by ship, were there if some of these 149 refineries, many of them are on the coast, particularly in Texas, but certainly bringing in the product to those to areas where you to where there are major metropolitan areas and the intersection of major metropolitan areas and refineries. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems to me that's an ideal situation, and that would obviously be a plus, Doug. But I think the problem is that I can think of at least two problems. One, ports are as constrained as not as the highway system, but there are a lot of constraints at ports. I have two coal clients at the moment, and both of them are searching for a port that they can take the coal out of. And one of the problems, I think, part of the what has happened there. I mean, there's a price of success, and international trade, I think most of us in the room would think, is a good thing. And the United States doesn't participate in international trade nearly as much as most of the other developed countries. So I think it's going to continue to grow. I always tell my port clients that. The problem is international trade is growing so fast, and the railroads are participating, for example, so much in the handling of containers that there isn't any room. It's crowding out the movement of coal and grain and other commodities. So there is a problem at the ports themselves that we shouldn't overlook. And there's also a problem getting from the port inland. Now, the Port of Los Angeles has done, I think, a very, very creative thing in something called the Alameda Corridor, where they've put pipelines together. They were actually going to have a dedicated truckway, which I thought was a brilliant idea. I think political pressure forced them to back down. But it is a very high density, very, very efficient, co-located, 700-foot-wide, 20-mile-long swath. And that's the that's where I think, if you really want to think strategically, that's where we need to go in Houston and New Orleans and in many of these port cities. But, of course, the political will to locate that. I mean, they probably spent 15 years trying to figure out politically where they could get this 700-foot swath in and minimize the damage. There happened to be a pretty obvious choice in Los Angeles. But to me, that's what you have to do. You have to concentrate this stuff, and it creates huge impacts on hopefully a relatively small number of people.
Well, the issues with respect to pipeline transportation of ethanol are going to be the same anywhere in the world. I think it's important that to recognize that we're still pretty much at the early stage of this development of biofuels. They've been developing very rapidly or expanding very rapidly in the last few years. But even in Brazil, there was a big push and a big ramp up in ethanol production in the 70s and early 80s, and then that fell off dramatically. So there is this ongoing question of, you know, critical mass in the demand on the demand side to determine what infrastructure is necessary to serve that market. The challenges are different between biodiesel and ethanol. I've had discussions with some Japanese sources, with JETRO, over, you know, all these press reports about connections between Brazil and Japan with respect to ethanol. And it looks like this is going to be this big new export market. And so I was inquiring about, you know, handling and even I think it's one of the Japanese companies has signed an agreement to do a feasibility study for a dedicated ethanol pipeline in Brazil. And it's still very much at the infancy stage. So I think until we have a better sense, I mean, this is one of these things where these markets are going to evolve over time, and then we'll figure out what sort of infrastructure is necessary. If they're mostly coastal markets and product is shipped in that way, then you may not see that much, you know, major infrastructure. A lot of the ethanol that's imported in the U.S. comes into the coastal markets. It's blended in the Northeast. It's blended in California. So it doesn't traverse the country. So I think we have to see how the market does evolve. One comment, we had some references to E85 and flex fuel vehicles. I actually have a flex fuel vehicle. And right now, the only place to get E85 inside the Beltway is at the PX next to the Pentagon. Now, I've been over there four times to fill my vehicle, and there's never been a car anywhere in sight that was attempting to use that particular pump. I would note that the price premium was 40 cents higher than premium gasoline. But at the same time, because this vehicle was manufactured with the assumption that it would operate on gasoline, it's certainly not optimized to run on E85. So my experience driving this car is actually worse than what you the stated discount in fuel economy of about 25% to 30%. It's been a lot lower than that. So we have this sort of catch-22 in the efficiency of use of these fuels as well, and we're still very much at the early stage. And so I think as far as how much additional capacity will be built and what the infrastructure will be in place to serve it is something that we'll have to see depending on how markets evolve and whether we do go to higher level blends in vehicles as they do in Brazil. The average blending of ethanol is about 20% to 22%, and most vehicles in Brazil can run on that as opposed to, you know, the dedicated ethanol vehicles that they had in the past. And in the United States, while we're expanding these FFVs, there's no effort to concentrate the marketing anywhere. So the infrastructure isn't really evolving yet. So I guess we just have to wait and see how the markets evolve before we determine what infrastructure will be put in place.
Is there a last question from the audience before we invite Eric to provide us some reflective comments? Why don't we do one further one, and then I'll provide an introduction for you.
I got one question for you, Charlie. Okay. If there are 150 refineries, and if they are expanding to create the equivalent of one new refinery a year, is that the way I understood it? So that's approximately, if my math is right, approximately a 2/3 of 1% increase in refinery capacity. Is that right? 1/150. Okay.
No. Actually, not, because not all those 149 refineries make gasoline.
Okay.
You can't lube.
So it's going to be less than 2/3.
About 1%.
Okay, 1%. Yeah. So if the growth in our demand for fuels this year with these higher prices is 2%, and I take your point very much about 2017, isn't it inevitable that the price of fuel is going to have to rise? And if so, this is a two-part question, and if so, how come so many people are saying that these are just temporary issues and the prices, in fact, will fall down to more moderate levels?
Well, speaking for NPRA, we do not predict what prices are going to be. We have no idea. The market sets the price. You will never see a prediction from. We can predict how much we're going to. We can predict how much fuel we're going to produce. We also can predict how much fuel will be used. But we let those folks who have a lot more, letters after their names than I have, figure out what the price is going to be. Now, one thing about price that I will comment on, and I've been around this town since mid-70s, I guess. I don't think we've been very good with our Ouija boards in predicting what price of anything is going to be. And, I think, you guys hit it on the head. We're increasing supply, demand by 2%. We can only do so much at the refineries. We're still bringing in imports. And that's good. I mean, no one's saying we shouldn't have imports, but there's a balance that you have to have. And they provide a critical service. Until the such time as demand comes down and supply comes up, I mean, what's happening out there is what I understand the textbooks say should happen. And that's, but for us to predict where anything's going to be other than what we can physically do is not, I don't think it's helpful for the debate, at least from our side. You'll never see us doing it.
Well, let's use that as a segue. Please join me in welcoming Eric Peterson. He's Senior Vice President here at CSIS and has been the co-sponsor as head of the Global Strategy Institute of this series, and has joined us, I think, for almost every session, and I think has some reflective comments, having now gone through 7 of them. And as we wrap this up, we'll be good to have some comment and reflection.
Doug, thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I promise to be brief. The first thing that I'd like to do is to congratulate our speakers this morning. It strikes me time and time again in the context of each of these sessions that we've had the tremendous layers of complexity that exist. I'm reminded of the time when I took my family to Santiago, Chile. My little boy, after a long night in the plane, we were waiting in the passport line in Santiago, and he pulled up my pants and said, "Daddy, they aren't speaking English here." And I said, no, we've talked about this. They speak Spanish here in Chile. And then he thought about it for a while and said, "But why don't they speak English? It's so much easier to understand." You know, as we've gone through each of these seven sessions, it strikes me that there's so much by way of complexity to the grammar, the grammatical construction, even the vocabulary of the whole issue of alternative transportation fuels in its various dimensions, that we all have our work cut out for us to define this new language. It's hard to believe, Doug, that we started this effort a little more than a year ago. Frank, you'll remember we had that session on hydrogen cells. It's unbelievable, and we've had seven terrific sessions since then. And at that time, I don't think that any one of us could have predicted the kinds of excellent conversation or these layers of complexity that have been covered in the context of these discussions. At the time, we wanted, our goal at the outset was to be forward-looking, to try to put some interesting thinking on the table, both with respect to the underlying dynamics on the one hand and the equally complex policy levers on the other. And I think we've done that, thanks to the contributions of a number of people, and we're very beholden to them for their role. Over the past year, we've covered a lot of territory. We've covered technology, the enormity of the fuels distribution system, all of the complexities associated with logistics, critical role of petroleum-based fuels, the investment and lead times needed to make necessary adjustments, and the promise and need for new and cleaner fuels more generally. I think Frank may have mentioned this when he kicked things off this morning, but the game plan now is to try to integrate all this thinking. What we hope to do is the three parties involved, namely the CSIS Energy Program, my group, the Global Strategy Institute, and clearly NREL, and Doug's great participation on both sides, is to put together a fuels report that somehow integrates some of the analysis that we've heard. We also hope to convene a larger session dealing with international biofuels, apropos that last set of remarks, later this year. A number of people have been engaged in this, and I'd just like to recognize them briefly. First, our partner, Frank Verastro, has been just an outstanding citizen here at CSIS. He's been supported mightily by Jennifer Bover and Alex. We'd like to thank them for all their incredible efforts in setting this up. We have a wonderful friend in Doug Arendt and NREL more specifically. And I'd like to thank all of you. Many of you have been to a number of these sessions, and I think it's been quite a journey going forward. It really strikes me, and this is the last point I'd like to make, it really strikes me that we have a tremendous amount of complexity to wade through to get to important policy issues at the various levels, federal down to local, that were discussed. And time is short. We need to be moving quickly. So with that, let me thank you all again for your participation here today. More information to come about future sessions. You can count on that. Thank you for your time, and we look forward to welcoming you back.